Can experiencing art improve your well-being? What better way to answer that question than to visit an art museum? Welcome to Viewscapes, stories from Washington State Magazine, connecting you to Washington State University, the state, and the world. I visited the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at WSU to talk with Museum Director Ryan Hardesty about how we benefit from seeing, hearing, and experiencing art. As we toured the Crimson Cube at WSU Pullman, the exhibits gave us plenty to contemplate and discuss. Join us as we head to the museum. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Larry.
And thanks for having me over at the museum today. And I'm looking forward to talking with you about some of the exhibits and how people feel when they see them and what people gain from seeing art.
Larry, I'm happy to have you, and it's a pleasure to talk about this. Of course, this is exactly what the museum's all about, kind of bringing people in and providing a space for exploration and discovery.
Should we head on in?
I'm excited to walk around with you and explore.
All right. Yeah, so this is right next to the entrance. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so we're standing outside of Trimpin's Ambient 432 installation. And I have to say that, you know, when we were talking about building a new museum on campus, we always knew that Trimpin was going to be a part of this project. He kind of shows up in the earliest concept drawings for the new museum, which is really cool. And so I commissioned Trimpin way back in 2016 to create this new work of art for the WSU community, and we debuted it when we had our grand opening in 2018. So it literally is a sound sculpture. It's activated by our movement through the space. And I think what's so interesting about this work that really connects to what we're talking about today is Trimpin really kind of designed it in thinking about creating a healing work of art for our community as well as for the staff.
Yeah.
I remember those conversations of him talking about he wanted something that people could come into, kind of soothe the nerves, you know, have a little bit of a recharge to their day.
And there's a particular tone, right? That
there is. So he tuned these horns to 432 hertz, which is a slightly lower tuning than the 440 that we're used to for middle A. So it's a little bit more of a resonant, kind of you feel it in your body. He kind of also connects it to sound frequencies that have been used in Tibetan prayer bowls, different things like that.
That's so cool. Should we check it out?
Let's walk in.
All right. And so it works by just walking around and...
It sure does. And so as we move across the space, we're going to hear it kind of activate.
Oh, yeah.
Larry, I think one of the neat things about this work of art that maybe is not readily understood is that everything we're hearing is an acoustical instrument. Nothing is amplified.
Oh.
So he's classically trained musician as well as now a fine artist. So what we're hearing is the vibration of reeds.
Oh,
he's
wow.
Pushing air through pump organ reeds in these horns.
So this isn't some digital.
It's not digital
digitally
at all,
created.
No.
Sound. Wow. Such a beautiful tone.
So we've, this work has really become a kind of favorite of ours, and we've started many visits to the museum in this space, often with our K-12 groups, our younger visitors.
Mm-hmm.
We'll actually have them come into this gallery and lie on the ground and just close their eyes and listen. You know, they don't know it, but what we're doing is actually taking them through a bit of a guided meditation.
Mm.
And then we find that everybody's just a little bit more relaxed when we go visit the rest of the exhibitions.
Yeah. I could see how that would work. Yeah. You know, I'm starting to feel relaxed now.
I am too. That's good. It's working for us as well.
That's wonderful.
I think music therapy is probably one of the more studied areas of art and healing. I'm no scientist and no doctor, so I can't go too deep into this, but, you know, I think there is evidence that auditory stimulation has been shown to kind of calm our minds, you know, kind of reduce our stress. Probably
yeah.
Depends on the type of music we're listening to, but...
Sure. But you mentioned Tibetan prayer bowls as an example,
yeah.
You know, and I've heard those, and they do have that tone that just relaxes you and settles you into a kind of a better mind.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Well, should we head
Great.
Into the rest of the exhibitions?
Yeah, let's do it. Oh, it's singing us away.
Yeah, it is.
All right, so we're entering the gallery hall now. Back in this space, we have three exhibitions on view. So where should we start? I might suggest that we start with Keiko Hara's exhibition.
Sure.
So this is kind of a longtime dream to have a retrospective of Keiko Hara's work. I've known her for just about 20 years and admired her art all along that time. She's now turning 80 this year, and this exhibition really marks about a 40-year retrospective of her endeavor. She was born in North Korea to Japanese parents and then moved to Japan when she was just 3. Spent about half her life there, but really wanted to come to America because she thought it would kind of offer her kind of greater artistic freedom. So she came and continued her studies here and then eventually took a position at Whitman College down in Walla Walla.
Oh, close by.
Close by. She's been there ever since. So what we're seeing here is a room full of just the richest color and subtleties of imagery that I think definitely connect to ideas of landscape, or forms of memory.
Yeah, this piece that we're looking at now, it's space, sky, and field, and you could feel it. You know, it's rich color and very evocative of exactly that.
Absolutely. I think much of her work is connected to ideas around strong connections we have to senses of place. Or maybe we all kind of hold in our hearts places that are very dear to us. We can think about like those important places we've been or maybe lived in our past. And that's a real kind of powerful thing, kind of centers us. And so I think a lot of her work is about that. And what I see in her work is this kind of mutual connection to both kind of thinking back to our homeland of Japan and the inland Japanese sea that we see in certain works, but then this kind of new home in Walla Walla, where the fields have kind of become her new ocean and a sense of space. And so in certain works, we'll see kind of a combination of those two influences and memories.
Yeah, I could definitely get that sense from it. And, you mentioned home and this sense of place, mm-hmm. and it is so powerful. It really is connected to our happiness and our well-being. Yeah. You know, for many of us, we think about our happy place, for lack of a better term.
Well put, Larry, yeah. I reflect on that often. I think sense of home and a sense of belonging is really powerful stuff. I think we all crave that. And I think about that for our students that come to WSU Pullman and they move great distances to join us here and they're away from maybe a home that's elsewhere. And how do we kind of provide a kind of a second home in their time here with us? And I think I like to believe that the museum can be a big part of that, that we can provide a very welcoming, inclusive space.
And I think it helps to, when you have art like Keiko Hara's work, that really, I think it, I'm not really all that familiar with her work, and instantly I feel a connection to it and feel that sense of joy just from the color even.
That's excellent. Yeah, I'm glad you're picking up on that.
So she works in different media?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that her foundation is printmaking. It's really where she started. And then she's kind of grown into painting throughout the years. So what we're seeing in this exhibition of, about 40 years worth of work is kind of both examples of her printmaking endeavor as well as her oil paintings.
And right now we're looking at some of those prints?
We are. We're looking at two columns that stretch from the floor straight up to the ceiling of lithographic prints. They're double-sided, so you can walk around these columns, and the imagery kind of course, develops and changes depending on our position in the room. We'll see different things on the backside of these columns. These were printed off of a stone in the lithographic process. Mm-hmm. And much of the imagery of what we're seeing on this is kind of harkens back to that idea of memory of the Japanese sea, like we were talking about earlier. So you might pick up on certain shapes that maybe resemble a shell or the sense of water on a tidal flat.
And I think I see, what might be seaweed or kelp forests in there.
Very good. That's an astute reading. She actually talks about memories of going down to the shore every morning and looking at what the ocean had washed up, and then left there, lying there, almost as if it had kind of laid out a new composition on the canvas, so to speak, of the beach every day. She actually became kind of really active shell collector at one point in her life. And she talks about that she had hundreds and hundreds of seashells, and she would kind of study their shapes and particularities, that she became so kind of obsessed with them that she would dream about the shells at night and kind of imagine new kind of ideas for her artwork through those dreams.
And speaking of joy and well-being, there's nothing like finding a really nice shell
on
the beach. So I hear what she's saying.
Yeah.
So what are some of these other pieces over here? Over here on the wall with the, it looks like a different treatment in blue, gray, red.
Exactly. We're looking at four woodblock prints here called Topophilia number 7. And this is actually a really important work for Keiko because it was at a moment in her career where she worked with a really established Japanese woodblock printer, kind of a master of his trade. And I think through that experience with working with that master printer, Keiko kind of saw new possibilities for what she could do with woodblock printing. And of course, if you know anything about the history of woodblocks, Japan has one of the longest histories of using that genre and that medium.
Yeah.
Right, and so Keiko was interested in taking that kind of history of those ukiyo-e prints that kind of emerged in the 18th century, 17th century, and developing them in a contemporary sense. What more could she do with them? Well, we have a series of four. We can also think of that we have four seasons, and mm-hmm. so there's maybe a kind of a connection point to that idea. In the central composition of each four prints is kind of a gate-like form, which she uses over and over in her work, this idea of kind of a portal, some sort of space, an internal space that we can cross through to enter the work and to travel, mentally, conceptually within the work. The works are so subtle, so rich in color. There's also a sense of writing on the works that she's collaged in. And Keiko tells me that these works actually are connected to a Japanese piece of theater that has to do with a kind of real kind of sad story of a mother looking for her lost son on the riverbanks.
Kind of thinking about art and looking at these, they do jump out at you. The color is so strong and so rich. And you mentioned that passageway to internal.
Yeah.
The internal space.
Spaces. Yeah.
So, I think that really it really reaches into you in many ways.
It does, yeah. And she's made both intimate works such as these, as well as really, maybe we could walk over here, works that are just monumental in their scale.
Yeah.
We're now looking at a four-panel oil painting that is, Larry, what is this? This is around 28 feet long, if I remember correctly.
It's really
towering above us. I think if we're feeling low in energy and we need a little color therapy, we just need to come back and stand in front of this work and get a jolt. Because the scale does allow that kind of immersive experience where we can almost get enveloped within this work's color and space. It wraps around us.
That certainly is what is happening here. I mean, these four panels put together, I wouldn't say overwhelming.
No.
But maybe... Yeah, in a good way.
I hope so.
I like the term envelop.
Envelop.
You stand in front of it and it wraps around you.
Well, they're very active, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're charged with movement and pattern. I definitely feel very stimulated by them visually. Keiko has talked a little bit about this work in reference to dreams again, mm-hmm. and just that idea of our dreams are often fragments when we wake up, and there's that frustrating moment of trying to recall just what you experienced in your dream world and
right.
how slippery that kind of reality is,
mm-hmm.
In the waking hours.
Yeah.
And so trying to hang on to those fragments of a dream is something that she's referenced with this work.
She certainly has wonderful dreams if she captures even fragments here.
I suspect that her dream life is pretty rich.
So these are called topophilia.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that word.
Yeah, that word is a word that's come to be connected to this idea of a profound love of places, that concept we were talking about earlier. It shows up through kind of the historical record by different writers through time, and she's adopted it. It's a real kind of guiding conceptual framework for much of her career.
Mm.
Again, what are those special places in our life? What do they mean to us? How do we access them via memory? Those spaces that are so profound to us could be literal, mm-hmm. you know, could be a pine forest up near Spokane, Washington, where I grew up, and the smell of those trees.
Yeah.
Or that could exist, you know, more kind of on a conceptual, you know, through our memory and our kind of recall of those spaces.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you know, and it comes through in her work, and I think that's, you know, we had talked about that, that sense of space and that that love of a place.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's wonderful. Should we look around some more?
Let's do it. Why don't we cross into another gallery? You're really making a gear shift. But we are looking at another Walla Walla-based artist, and this is the work of Juventino Aranda. He's a younger artist in his 30s, and this is about a 10-year survey of his recent work. And I'm very proud of this work. I came to know him when he was still a student at Eastern Washington University, and he was completing his BFA. And you know when you meet those bright students, and they've got all the right stuff, you know, and he was that. I saw in him this artist that was going to definitely go far, because he was already kind of trying to place his work, you know, at the highest level. He was kind of trying to set it up on the same shelf as the artists that we really look up to. And I admired that kind of aspirational aspect. So much of Juventino's work, again, I think there's some shared themes across all of our exhibitions right now this fall. And like Keiko and her kind of journey from Japan to America and what that meant for her, Juventino's work is so much about also trying to find a sense of home in America where he was born, mm-hmm. his parents migrated out of Mexico a generation mm-hmm. before. And so this sense of feeling a degree of foreignness within Juventino's homeland is at the core of his work. So we're gonna look at the largest work in the exhibition. This piece is created at the exact same dimensions as Monet's Water Lilies. And Monet painted, I think, upwards of 170 to 200 water lily paintings in his career. So there's not just one canvas. But there's a particular Water Lilies piece that hangs at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And this work of Juventino Aranda's is in reference to that.
Okay.
It's made to the exact same dimensions. Just like Monet's Water Lilies at the MoMA, this piece has kind of a triptych organization with a left and right wing that kind of fold out to us. And Monet always talked about that he had envisioned all of his water lilies at some point being hung in the round, so that you could kind of step in and be fully immersed in this tapestry of light and color and, you know, reflection, the surface of the water and that interplay of light on those surfaces of lily pads. And so Juventino's picked up on that, and he's referenced the lily pads in certain areas of his composition. But the big difference here, of course, is, well, there's no color.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all monochromatic, essentially.
It's black on black.
Yeah.
What we're seeing in front of us, Larry, is gradations of texture, mm-hmm. And reflectivity from kind of gloss to matte that give us a sense of composition. We can see where those lily pads are, you know, by their difference in kind of materiality, the thickness of the paint, the reflectivity. What's Juventino after here? You know, in some ways he's talking about what happens when we pull away all the color in the world. The title of this work is Fog of War. Mm. And so we might start to think a little bit about, you know, a battlefield here, you know, that kind of sense of a charred space, a burnt over landscape, which isn't the happiest of ideas, is it? But I think it's a good reminder of what war can take away.
Right. You know. Well, that makes me think too, you know, you have a piece like this, again, immersive, you know, just in its scale. The more you look at it, the more you see, which is fascinating. You know, when I first looked, I didn't see some of the detail in the gradations you're talking about. But it does have kind of a very ominous feel in some ways.
Yeah.
So how does that help somebody who's going to a gallery to see a piece like this that might have kind of a darker meaning?
Yeah.
What does that do for somebody?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate so much what you just said. I mean, first, yes, art does unfold over time, and it deserves to be seen over and over again, because we'll depending on the day and how long we spend with work, we're going to take more and more away from it. And then to your second point, absolutely. Not all art is, you know, of course, created to soothe. I think art and artists have long played an important role in society as being kind of agents of change. And what I love about artists that are really pushing ideas and presenting difficult ideas is they give us, we can think of them and their art almost as a screen upon which we can project our own ideas and fears and aspirations. But the artist can act as a bit of a mediator. It makes it less personal, right? Mm. Hopefully it decreases the level of confrontation between, you know, in a polarized society and kind of gives us something to kind of wrap our thinking around. So that I think in that way it's helpful and instructive. You know, artists can pose difficult questions for us. It's a safe space to come and explore those ideas here in the museum.
And it does. It stirs ideas. It kind of gets you thinking. And I like what you said because it makes it less personal, less, you know, confrontational, and allows somebody to absorb a piece like this, this Fog of War by Rhonda, to really, you know, take what you can from it.
That's right.
You know, so, yeah.
I think one of the great attributes of art and art appreciation is maybe sadly something that I think it's being a little bit lost in society right now. And for me, it's this idea of our ability to really linger and dwell in zones of ambiguity, right? To enter spaces of unknowing, the gray matter of life, right?
Right.
And that's what the world's about.
Yeah.
And we've become a little too polarized,
yeah,
a little too black and white. And I think art keeps kind of forcing us to be open to new ideas, new perspectives that are not our own, and to be okay with that.
Yeah. I think that's well said. Yeah. And it's wonderful because looking at, and to think, you know, a young artist was able to put together, you know, this beautiful art, I'm very excited for what he does in the future, too.
We are, too. He's going to go far. Well, let's walk across the hallway. We're going to look at one more exhibition, which is a really exciting project that we did in collaboration with WSU Libraries, and specifically the Manuscripts, Archives, and Special Collections branch of the libraries. They have the most tremendous collection of photographs by a photographer named Irwin Nash. Irwin Nash started traveling out to the Yakima Valley in our state around 1967. He was on assignment to document migrant farm working communities there that were working in the fields, that were living in the valley to help with agricultural work.
Right.
He got hooked. Trust was kind of grew between him and the community and the families, and he started going back every summer, and he went back 10 summers in a row. Hmm. By the end, he created a kind of collection of almost around 9,400 photographs. And this is where I get a little foggy on my history, but at some point WSU happily made a purchase of that collection and entered the library's collections. Mm. So only recently has this collection really started to get its due in that it's been fully digitized at this point. And the great stewards at the library of this collection have started sharing each image on Facebook. Mm. With the communities there in the Yakima Valley, mm-hmm, with the idea, hey, help us figure out what we're seeing here. These are your stories, not ours. They're your relatives.
Right.
What's happening in this image? Who is that aunt? What was that event that was photographed by Irwin Nash all those years ago? So that's kind of, you know, what we're looking at right now. This is obviously not 9,400 images in this exhibition. It's around 40. It's a small selection. Mm-hmm. But you can see in the ways in which it connects to Juventino Aranda's exhibition. Again, it's about, you know, migration. Why do people travel? For work, for a sense of building a home.
Yeah.
From a largely Mexican-American community in this case.
Right. Yeah, and it's a community that I don't think has been seen all that much, you know, in the past. So it's wonderful to have a collection of this. You know, I'm looking around the room at these black and white photos, you know, of people in their lives. You know, this one over here with the father with the baby.
It's a father and a child image, a real tender moment.
Yeah.
We you know, like I was saying, this collection is so expansive, you know, and so how are you going to curate it into an exhibition? And, you know, we worked with Lippy Turner-Rahman as a guest curator from the library, and Lippy and I talked really early on about that we wanted this exhibition to really focus on intimate moments, you know, because I think even, you know, the term migrant labor is so problematic, because that doesn't sound like a person, does it?
No.
That's just like
it's a cog in the machine.
It's a cog. It's invisibility. We don't know. You know, but these are real people with real lives, of course. And they're people that still live in the valley. And so we thought, okay, of course the collection talks about protest and different, you know, labor movements, you know, Cesar Chavez, different aspects of activity within the valley to gain better rights and working conditions. But we wanted this exhibition to focus a little more on those intimate moments in the home, around the home, that really humanize this collection and these people.
Yeah. These really are like windows into their lives. You know, making meals and, you know, a girl, is that her quinceañera?
That is her quinceañera, yes.
You know, and you could just get the feel of joy that they have in family with some of these celebrations. And
yeah,
absolutely.
It really comes through. You're right, it's these intimate moments.
And I would never wish to speak for the community, but my sense is that this has been really kind of a powerful project for individuals involved, you know, and we're kind of talking about art and well-being today in this conversation, and I think there's actually something about being represented kind of in the historical record in a really respectful way that gives a person a sense of, I don't know, what? Belonging, sense of being seen, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this project has a lot to do with that.
But I know, you know, for me, not being a member of the community, this really helps me feel that empathy and connect to them in some small way, you know, through these photos.
There's this great photo right here. I mean, there's so many amazing images, but there's this image of these boys. What are these? I think we're looking at four boys, although it almost looks like three, but there's a fourth boy just in the shadow.
Yeah.
They're standing in a doorway, and they're just full of laughter. You know, there's something just cracked these boys up, and they're having a good giggle. But what I love in this image is there's this amazing moment where when you're looking, you realize that the boys have shared their shoes with one another. That he's wearing the shoe of his friend, and, you know, maybe his friend has the other left foot of his, you know. So,
yeah.
Just those little charming details.
I love that detail. And they do look like they're having such a great time. You know, they have improvised toys out of wood, maybe?
It looks that way, yeah. I used to do that myself.
Oh,
me too.
You know, my piece of wood that was a sword that slayed every dragon in the woods.
That's
you know?
Right.
So,
excellent.
This is a wonderful photo.
Yeah.
You know, and looking at things like this, you know, this photo and some of these other pieces, you know, we've looked at, you know, what's the sense that people can take away? You know, once they leave the gallery, what have they gained from looking at these pieces?
That just cuts right to the crux of what the museum's all about. That's a big question. You know, of course, our goal is to provide access to new ideas, you know, and to allow us to grow and enrich ourselves. I think art can go a long way, especially as we consider globalization, and that there's a real premium put on mediums that can kind of create an empathetic response across cultures. You spoke to that earlier. So that's certainly what I hope this experience is about. But we're also talking about well-being, right, and happiness. And I think too often health is defined too simply. You know, often we define health by, let's say, the absence of sickness or illness, right? I think a more holistic definition of health, of course, it's that, physical well-being, but it's also mental well-being, and then social well-being. How is society doing? What's the health of society? I like to think that creative expression and art and museums have a large role to play within that kind of societal well-being.
Thanks for listening to Viewscapes. Our music was by WSU Regents Professor Greg Yazanitsky. To read more about happiness through art and all our stories, Visit magazine.wsu.edu.